Brew Strong is brought to you by Blickman Engineering, home of the Riptide. Visit them online at blickmanengineering.com.
Brewers, it's time for the beer radio you've been looking for. This is the show that dispels myths, tackles the toughest topics, and makes no apologies for geeking out on beer. Hosted by two guys that drink before they think, Jamil Zainashev and John Palmer. This is Brew Strong.
Hey, howdy. Hey, my brewing brothers and sisters.
What's up, y'all?
Howdy. Ugh, not there yet.
Oh, man. Michael, that made it worth it, though.
Greetings, greetings is tough to beat.
We got to do some work with you. I don't know. All right.
I have some inspiration. You know, Jamil's Hey, Howdy, Hey comes from, I think it's Toys.
Comes from... From Disneyland.
We were
driving back from Wyoming, from a city in Wyoming, place where they have the shoes made out of a dead man's skin, that place. And I was driving back with my kids. And
you want to repeat that? My
shoes made of a dead man's skin. You haven't seen those before?
Oh, yeah, I have a pair of those.
Right. Size 10 and a half.
Yeah. Oh, no, mine are bigger.
Yeah, there's a place where there's shoes made of a dead man's skin. So this guy was hung for whatever reason, you know, robbing or whatever. And so the local like dentist or whatever, or doctor, mayor, I can't remember the story. He took a bunch of his skin and had it tanned and had some shoes made out of him.
There's a really good joke in that.
Here you go.
The man hung with his skin shoes, whatever, you know.
No, it's a real thing. It's quite fascinating. They also have a where am I thinking of? Oh, but they have a territorial prison there. You know, one of the last operating gas chambers.
Operating?
Well, back in the day.
Okay.
They hung people, and you can see where they hung people. And then they moved to something more modern, which is a gas chamber, and they still have the gas chamber there. You can actually sit in it. So I'm there with my two daughters. It gotta be like 10 and 8 or 9 and 7, something like that. And so we're taking the tour, and there's probably 20 people there. And they're showing us, and they go, "This is the gas chamber. And the last person was executed in, 1950, 70, whatever." And they said, X number of people were executed there. And they go, "Does anybody want to sit in it and get a picture?" I'm like, "Yep." My kids are like, "Yep." And everybody looks at us like we are just like the scum of the earth. Like, total disrespect, for the people who died there. Well, and people who died there, I don't know. They were killed for some reason. I don't know.
Right.
And so maybe they weren't the greatest of people. I don't know if anybody innocent was executed there. But we're like, yeah. And so we're sitting there, we each sit there and take pictures, and everyone's just standing there judging us. It was hilarious. But, I will say, sitting in a gas chamber where people were executed, it is a very weird feeling.
I expect.
It was Rawlins. I think it was Rawlins. Rawlins, Wyoming? Rawlins, Montana? Forgive me. A wonderful experience to check it out. It's just mind-blowing. And you sit there, and just kind of the weight of everything. And just you think for a moment, it's like, what if I was here being gassed? And it really is a very moving experience. And I think the people who didn't sit there kind of missed out on you know, kind of viewing it from the people who were executed side of things. It's very easy to say, hey, you know, you execute somebody because they're bad people. You know, you see it from the other side a little bit. And maybe we shouldn't be executing people so quickly, or, you know, or, you know, maybe there's some other option. I don't know. But it was pretty moving to sit there. And my kids say the same thing. And I think, you know, that was an important lesson for them as well. So maybe I'm not so bad a parent that, you know, we discuss these things afterwards. So
at what point did somebody say, hey, howdy, hey?
Anyway. So we're driving back, and then my, you know, my daughters are choosing the music, and my youngest daughter, you know, she was into the Disney tunes, and so we have CDs of all the Disney songs from, you know, Disney themed songs from the park or whatever they are, volumes 1 through 30 or whatever they are. And so one of them, the songs has Hey Howdy Hey is one of the things in it. And so we're all singing along. And then she really loved the song. And I said, look, I will use it on the show. So she's like, you will? And she was really thrilled. And so I'm like, yep, I will. And so so I did. And it stuck. And so I've been doing it ever since.
That might be your best story ever. That was outstanding. Yeah, so I had a mixed up memory on it. I knew it was Disney. I thought somehow it was Toy Story or something like that. And so the best thing I can do with my 3-year, 9-month-old son is I could take from Cars. He loves to show Cars. I could give you a ka-chow.
Oh, ka-chow. There you go. Now, see, now you're talking. Now you have an intro. All right.
I can do ka-chow. Uh-huh. And it'll have to be third, though, Michael. So you'll have to come up with something in between there. I can finish it up with a ka-chow. Give a flash of the greasy forehead. Ka-chow.
I don't know. I gotta get on my Disney game so I can find something.
that or you know, some place that somebody was gassed, you know, whatever your story comes from. Your origin story is your personal thing.
Right. All right. Speaking of origin stories, I'm not sure how it turned out that Blickman ended up sponsoring this show and has continued to do it. I mean, every day I figure, you know, Justin will go like, yeah, Blickman pulled the plug because, you know, he's tired of paying for this crap. And, you know, we'll be off the air. I don't know. He still writes the checks. God bless him. I love that man. He's a fine dude. Again, you know, the interesting thing is these folks that we talk about, you know, they really do want, you know, all brewers, home brewers and professional brewers, every brewer to make the greatest beer possible. And why? I think one, because they're nice people, but two, and it means better beer for them too. I think, and you know, they love the community and they love the hobby and they love the profession and they want to contribute something to it, to say when they on their deathbed, I actually gave back. I made a big difference to the community. And that's what Blickman's doing, you know, by sponsoring the show. I think he's helped a lot. We've helped a lot of people throughout the years brew better beer. Spawned a lot of, you know, small craft brewers out there. So, you know, a lot of that is, you know, because Blickman has paid for the show so everybody could listen to it for free, not behind any paywall. You get this for free. So that's all Blickman's dime that you're enjoying. So what I would like to say is if you get a chance, you go to blickmanengineering.com, check out the stuff there. If they don't have any local homebrew shop, go into your local homebrew shop and say, hey, can you get me this stuff? You know, or, you know, what do you think of this stuff? It's good equipment. The guy doesn't, you know, do anything halfway. He's a really smart engineer that has a great passion for doing this right. And one of the things, the new products they've come out with is a 3.5 barrel tall boy fermenter for small commercial breweries. If you open a commercial brewery, this thing will fit through a 36-inch doorway. This thing is taller, so it doesn't take up as much floor space. It actually has no ports on the back. They're all, everything, every connection's on the front. You can tuck this thing up tight to a wall, tight to a corner, save space. You know, you don't want to spend more on square footage than you have to. So TC, you should just say that. You should just say it out loud. He says, go ahead, say it out loud.
I wonder who he modeled that tall, skinny thing off of.
Well, I don't think it's any of us. I think we're all not tall me. Or skinny. Some of you guys are tall. None of us is skinny, I think.
Nope.
Anyways, so, you know, check them out. Everything from, you know, really solid basic homebrew equipment to, you know, the great homebrew equipment with lots of bells and whistles to inventing new ways of doing things to, you know, great, you know, small commercial brewing gear. Check them out, BlickmanEngineering.com. And if you get a chance, send them an email, feedback@BlickmanEngineering.com. Tell them thank you for sponsoring the show. Let's see here. Garth in the chat was asking, what is, and if you're listening live, you can go to me on Facebook. You just click on the comments link and then it pops up. You can ask your questions. You can see everybody else's questions as well. What's each of your spicy takes on something in the brewing world, i.e. something popular or a held belief, but you disagree with it strongly? Let's start with Travis. What do you disagree with that's like common things people say and when talking about brewing, you disagree with strongly?
Well, you know, when you met me, Jamel, I was a massive dick, and I'm not quite that guy these days.
You're a much smaller dick now.
Exactly. Yes, it's shrunken. It's wilted, you know. So I'm not, and you've had a lot to do with this. I'm not passionate about what other people shouldn't be doing, but I'm very passionate about telling them what I do. And if they don't want to do it, that's fine. I've had people like, why do you do that? Like, does it works? Because I've had good success with like the beer. So I really don't have this. Oh, that's crap. I've got some interesting questions. I really want to be on your Lalaman call if I can be on it, if I can get the time to be on it. So I've got some interesting questions, but I don't have any of that, I don't think. Sorry, I'm glad you started with me so y'all can build it up better and I just started off.
All right, Michael.
Spicy take. I'm trying to think of something good, but I'm drawing a blank.
Guys will let me down here. We will come back to you.
Yeah, let me. Oh, man, I stink.
Well, not as much as I do. It's really hot in my garage.
No, so one of the things I rant about frequently was, you know, the fermentation dry hopping. I totally disagree with that. I think that, you know, when people were saying when we're first figuring out how to make, you know, great hazy beer, you know, one of the things was, oh, you have to fermentation dry hop because you get the biotransformation. And so we actually, you know, went ahead and did that. We did side-by-side batches of, you know, the dry hops went into fermentation, or the dry hops were held until the end of fermentation and were added then. And then we did blind triangles with people, and every last soul picked the one that was dry hopped at the end of fermentation, not during fermentation. Their comment on the ones fermented during fermentation was that they were harsh and bitter, and there was some weird off taste in them they didn't like. And it makes sense to me because you're stirring the hops, the hop material up, the leaves. You've already extracted everything you need in the first few hours. And then you're just extracting all that leaf matter, nasty stuff. And it just is the wrong way to go. Instead, I keep advocating that if you want biotransformation, take all your linalool and geraniol rich hops and put them in the whirlpool, extract out the you know, from them there, you know, at 175 degrees Fahrenheit or lower, and then that will be biotransformed during fermentation without all the leaf matter, which gives you the off flavor. So I really hate that people keep pushing this fermentation dry hopping. So that's my spicy take right there.
Well, you know, the Phantasm people back you.
Huh?
Phantasm people back you. They tell you to add the Phantasm in the whirlpool.
Oh, yeah, there you go.
And that's thiol precursors, right?
Right.
That's there. I mean, it's the linalool geraniol is the one of the two main we focus. I mean, there's many that you probably don't even know about biotransformation, but the other one's the thiol biotransformation. They don't say dump it in your fermenter. They say get it in your whirlpool. So yeah, I mean, and they go so far as to mash hop to get some precursors out of your malt. So you're talking about biotransformation that's going to happen in the fermenter. It starts off with the mash in some people's concepts. We could probably have someone on here with a very spicy take on mash hopping also. You know,
I hate mash hopping. first word hopping, all that. Hopping, yeah. Oh, that's crap.
I don't
spicy. I think I got one. I got two, actually.
Okay. So you're only allowed one.
Okay. Well, I've actually gotten a couple times into kind of agitated, I guess would be that means it's spicy when you get all agitated at.
Yes.
I really, really, really don't like when people say all hazy taste the same. It's all the same.
Yeah, that's nonsense.
Or somebody says it's like, you know, it's not a good style or cause they're all the same. And I just go into this big rant about all these things. And like you're saying with the just the way that you make it, there's so many possibilities. There's so many ways to express the flavors differently and more complex and more interesting. It's like, if you're tasting the same thing every time, I don't know what you're drinking, but it's not stuff I'm making or stuff I'm buying. So,
right.
I can expand on that.
Yeah.
that's the people who had three hazies and said they all tasted the same.
Because we'll
go into this. There's a new name. It's not even that new. There's so many products you can buy to just dump right into your work these days. You don't just have to use hops. You can use Incognito, you name it. And I think people abuse it. And I think a lot of those NEPAs do taste the same.
Mm.
But then there are the good NEPAs that don't all taste the same. So, yeah. So anyone who says, oh, I don't like that style of beer, and they talk down about that style of beer as if it's a bad style of beer, they probably haven't had the good versions of that beer in general, except for the fruited smoothie thing. They all suck.
I'm waiting for a good one.
Yeah. You haven't given up. Good for you.
After living through the horrible hazies, and then like tasting some good ones, I'm like, oh, right. Okay. I'm now seeing that, you know, the potential of this style. Mm-hmm. And now there's a lot of great ones now. But, you know, there was a time there when there was a lot of bad. There's still probably vastly more bad ones than there are really great.
I would agree with that. Hot take.
I mean, thousands of breweries making thousands of shitty beers. And
but
some making exceptionally great beers.
You know, I learned that, you know, the same thing happened to me on hoppy Belgian beers. I was just like, make a really hoppy Belgian beer without it tasting just horrible. Cause you know, the phenols and the dryness and all that is really going to collide with, you know, a lot of the various, characters of the hops, and it's going to be horrible. And then Steve Vicario in Captain Lawrence, I had some of his beers. I'm like, oh my God. All right. Here's somebody who knows how to marry Belgian character with hop character. And that was just, you know, a game changer for me. And so I was convinced, yeah, you can make hoppy Belgians, but I'm sure you can go back and find where I said, no, you can't combine the two. It's just crap.
I don't know if you put that
was wrong. You know, same thing on the hazies. Hey, I'm wrong every once in a while. Newsflash for you folks who are listening. I make some mistakes, but hey, I try. All right. And I will tell you when I'm wrong. As long as I know that I was wrong, I'm sure I'll tell you. I freely admit. Let's do this. One quick short break, and we'll be back right after this.
Back to the beer guys that make other beer guys look like wine guys. Brew strong.
All right, we're back. Brent in the chat asks, hey, gentlemen, since it's about hop season, I've got a question. How would you go about designing a fresh, wet hop beer? unpredictable AA levels, alpha acid levels, and flavors of wet hop is probably really different than their pellet form. Currently, we'll have a decent amount from my friend who is growing Newport, Southern Cross, and Tea Maker hops. Suggestions, tips, ideas? I think it's a good question, Brent. I will say this. Yes, there's a huge difference between fresh hops and our wet hops. And there's a difference between wet and fresh. Fresh is first harvest that's dried. Wet is first harvest that wasn't dried at all. Then the pellet form, the substantial difference between AA levels is that weight. So wet hops have 7 times more water than pellet hops. So, and you would need 7 times more in general to get the same bittering values. So I would not use wet hops for bittering values.
That was a question. Can it still be a wet hop beer if you use some CTZ bittering and wet hop for the flavor?
I would think so. If you're just doing bittering with a hop charge of pellets or whatever, I think that's perfectly fine. You know, wet hop beers are more about the expression of the wet hops in the flavor and aroma.
Right. It's not a single hop, just a wet hop.
Right.
Yeah.
I will say, I said this in a previous show, giving this guy lots of press, but I was kind of impressed with this guy, Adrian Cook from Blue Lake Hops. They have a method of packaging wet hops so that they're like stable. Have you ever tried freezing wet hops?
I feel like
or even refrigerating them?
Yeah, I'm sure you get lots of moisture in the package as it comes out of the hops.
They break down and turn to slime.
Ooh,
very quickly.
Not good.
And so this guy at the AHA Homebrewers Conference in San Diego, he showed me these hops, and he told me, oh, these were picked and packaged like, I don't know, it was like 6 months earlier, whatever, June versus August or September, whenever they harvested them. And these things, to me, they were very, very close to a hop you had just picked off the plant. I was very surprised. They were spongy, you know, like a hop cone is. They were fresh. There was no breakdown of the leaf matter. And he says they can ship year round wet hops. So I was pretty surprised. So let's get back to Brent's question. Have either of you guys made a wet hop beer? All right.
Go ahead, Michael, please, because I have not.
My mom is quite the prolific hop grower, and she has Cascade going over her patio all over. It's huge. And so I grabbed a bunch of that. And what I can say is I do the bittering with hops. I have an alpha acid number 4, so I can design the beer to have the right bitterness. I use the wet hops in the Whirlpool and then again in the dry hop. Also, shout out Brent. He's in my homebrew club. So what's up, Brent? And then, but as far as wet hops go, I ended up with quite the kind of woody character that I can only attribute to you're not drying the hops. So a lot of those woody myrcene kind of flavors are still in the hops. They haven't been driven off through the kilning process. So I called it my stick beer because it had a lot of interesting flavors that you only get from wet hops, I guess. But that wood character was very present. It did start to diminish over time as the beer ate, but I told myself if I ever made another one of these, I was going to build a hop oast and actually dry the hops out in the porch and then drive off that unwanted character to get to the good stuff, you know?
Right.
Did you alter your technique with this wet hop? Did you hop it longer, shorter, blah, blah, blah? Obviously 7X or 4X more, but
I did 5 times the weight. So I actually, it's crazy. I put a video up on my Instagram brewery page where I'm whirlpooling with like 40 ounces of hops in a 10 gallon kettle. What is happening? And then when I dry hopped, yeah, I had to go get like a whole nother pound of dry hops or of hops and pick them off the vines. And I've got my whole living room is ripped up, has vines everywhere in the kitchen where I've been picking these. It's just a wild. My hands were like yellow by the end of it. And It was fun, but it was a lot.
I think, you know, one of the things about the wet hops is there's some compounds in there that get driven off when they dry the hops. They blow warm air through the hops, and I think it drives off some compounds that we're not used to in beer. And a lot of people, Tasty famously hated wet hop beers. He just like, this is the most disgusting thing ever.
Yeah.
And so I think, you know, if you're in that camp, I would use the wet hops just in the boil kettle and let some of that stuff volatilize off. I think.
Question on that, Jamil. In the kettle sounds like a good reason for hop creep, because these are unkilled, not even low kiln hops. Mm-hmm. So if you dry hop with wet hops, would you? Well, all right. So if you whirlpool with wet hops, so you bring it in warm enough to kill off that enzyme that may or may not give you hop creep, versus if you dry hop, it's all there.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you can get ALDC these days. I think that's the right product, which I have some of it, haven't used. But with Celebration's been a wet hop beer forever, and ALDC is relatively new. So if you throw it in a kettle in your whirlpool, 160 plus, are you preventing hop creep because of that temperature?
I don't think so. I think you get hop creep from, you know, kiln hops as well.
That is a good point, though. I think if I ever, I'll rephrase what I said. If I ever do another wet hop beer using those hops, I'm going to make a style where I'm not dry hopping. Like I'll do a Pilsner, or I'll do an American cream ale or something where it's wet hopped in the kettle, and I can see how that turns out.
Yeah.
I like that idea.
Oh, there
you're welcome. Send me a bottle, please.
I will. I got to go over and check them out. They're probably getting close to being ready.
So Brent calls you the big redheaded giant. So clearly he's met you before or seen you.
Yeah.
That makes more sense now.
Yep. He's cool. He does a lot of experimental beers. Like he did this beer where he threw a log in the wort just so he could let it ferment with whatever yeast was in the wood.
Log beer.
Yeah, log beer.
Brave man.
Yeah. I never really heard what happened with that, but
Brent in the chat has a second question. Again, if you're listening live, you get to just click on the comments section of the Facebook page and you can ask your questions live and we'll try and get to all of them. Let's see here. He says that, what would your signature beer that people would know you for homebrewing? I can answer this for Travis.
Yeah.
This is a Dirty Diaper.
I knew it. I knew you'd know it.
Got him.
Thank you.
Which is a black double IPA, or I don't know, you know, it's like
Cascadian dark,
but double IPA. I don't know. It's a really good beer.
Thank you.
He's tweaked and refined that over the last decade and really made it into a great beer. Michael, what about you?
I think my claim to fame currently is my single hazy. I call it Mosaic Implications. That's the one that took first place at NHC's first round. Didn't do so hot at the final round, but, you know.
It's a hard good style beer for a second round, et cetera, and shipping and all of the above.
Oh, yeah. But I'm really proud of that beer. I do the non-GMO Tropicale yeast from White Labs that I think makes the beer just up a notch. And then I do a Mosaic. It's Mosaic, Simcoe, and Idaho 7, which gives a really neat, interesting flavor profile that I just think it doesn't taste like normal, like some of the hazies that you buy. I can see the comments on Facebook where 80% aren't that good, but
that sounds
delicious. That's why I make them myself. Yeah. And
sounds delicious to me.
Yeah.
I love those hops.
So I'm a hop head. I won't lie. So yeah, my hazies are kind of my hallmark that I really, really want people to appreciate that style, because it's like, for me, it's a lot of fun. And a lot more, a lot more room to express different traits and stuff, and you know, haze degree, malt profiles, yeast selection. It for me, that's where I get my fun. Making classic styles is all good, but this hazy stuff is like an ocean of possibilities that I
now for me. You're gonna have to tell me. I don't know, what would my signature beer be that people would know me for in homebrew.
Well, yeah. Before I knew you, Jamil, it was obviously drew a blank just like that, probably about a can of it somewhere around here. Evil Twin. But once you went pro, I mean, Shallow Grave, outstanding, and a metal. Evil Cousin, Evil magnificent 3? West Coast IPA.
Evil 3 is the beer that, like, it made me, like, I tried that beer, I was like, wow.
But, wow. Oh, hang on.
I think I would hope that people would remember me for Evil 3 because, of course, that's not homebrew.
True that. But
you know, because it's tasty, it's Mitch Steele, it's, you know, there's so much personal. Michael Ferguson. Oh my God.
Mufasa. Hey, Mufasa.
Oh, worry. Yes.
I don't know if you had a homebrew version of it. This beer's outstanding.
No, that was like the second or third beer we brewed when we started Heretic was Worry. It was a Chardonnay barrel aged Belgian golden with Brett, and it's really, really a great beer.
Oh yeah.
Yeah. Of all the beers, you know, that we made at Heretic, I actually have some of that in my fridge because, you know, they're not going to make anymore.
When it runs out, I'm going to cry.
Yeah. Michael Ferguson, we should have him on the show. Huh? Says that's the issue. 80% of the hazies just aren't that good. I imagine, you know, he and I go back and forth on decoction, you know, and he's an excellent brewer and just a wonderful person. And I imagine that he is not that pleased with hazies in general, although, you know, he's an honest dude. So if he tastes something and it tastes good, he'll tell you it tastes good.
I'll send him some.
Well, part of Mufasa's legacy, you might say, but that's kind of premature to say it, I guess. He's brewed at Gordon Beers for many years, right?
Yeah, and then it was when I met DJs. Him, he was in Las Vegas at, I can't remember the name of it. It wasn't 777 or...
Whatever it is in Vegas, he never
Michael,
mentioned it.
Michael, if you're still listening,
forgot those days.
Where are you brewing in Vegas? I met him in Vegas. It was funny. I had so many entries to second round entries to ship that I got like a giant marine igloo cooler to pack all of them in there and then ship this giant igloo cooler to Las Vegas. And it went to the brewery that he was the head brewer at, and went in, and he was just like, it's like, dang, he's like, if nobody's going to take this, he's like, I'd love to have this brand new giant igloo cooler. And then I showed up and was like, hey, that's my cooler. And I took my cooler back, but I think I owe him a cooler. But I remember it was some sort of rye beer that he was brewing there that was just spectacular. It was like the greatest rye beer I think I've ever had, and he it was his recipe and his and he brewed it. I remember going into his fermentation room. There was like a sealed, you know, door, and when you went through, there was a tray of sanitizer that you had to step in to sanitize your shoes before you could walk into his fermentation room. This is one of the reasons that I'll tell you why this guy's because he looks out for all the details. He wants to make sure that everything's perfect, you know, in the fermentation.
He's doing a lot to support the homebrew community here in Houston these days.
Yeah,
I mean, he's available constantly to answer questions, critique, et cetera, tell you what you need, tell you what you should do.
He always has.
Yeah, he's outstanding.
Super nice guy. All right, let's see here. Time for break number 2. Gonna take a short break. When we come back, we'll have more of your questions right after this.
Are you looking for a simple brewing system that's great for all grain brewing, but everything on the market seems to be full of compromises? Blickman Engineering has the answer. The Blickman Brew Easy All Grain Brewing System. The Brew Easy is a complete system with easy upgrades and a beautiful compact design, perfect for any size brewing location. At its core, the Brew Easy is built on two gorgeous Blickman Boilermaker brew kettles, a high temperature March pump, and either a top tier gas burner or the new boil coil electric heater. The Brew Easy adapter lid allows the pots to stack stack on top of each other, forming an efficient, strong, and compact brewing setup that comes in 5, 10, and 20-gallon batch sizes. Upgrade your BrewEasy system with full automated control by adding a Blickman Tower of Power temp controller, and make moving around easy with the Blickman Kettle Cart. The BrewEasy is modular. If you already own a Boilermaker kettle, you can build your BrewEasy by purchasing just the modules you need. The new BrewEasy all-grain brewing system. See it today at BlickmanEngineering.com and brew with Blickman quality on your new BrewEasy.
Learning to brew has never been so disgusting. This is Brew Strong.
All right, we're back. We're answering your live questions. A lot of good questions in the chat already, and we haven't had a lot of chance to get to your questions, because you can send your questions in if you can't participate live. You can send email brewstrong@thebrewingnetwork.com. You can send your questions in. If you send your questions in now, I'm giving preferential treatment to the latest questions, and then we're only mixing in a few of the older questions. So I will get to every question that is ever sent into the show, but sometimes it may take some time. Let's see here. John says, there are so many different yeast nutrients now. I still use Servo. Should I change it up? What are you guys using?
I actually only use nutrients in the starter, and I will do a gram per 100 billion started, and it's Fermato, which I bought at Brew Chatter, RIP, but RJ talked me into trying that out, and it's worked really well, and I think it really helps with...
I like Fermato. It's essentially amino acids and other nitrogen that the yeast can take up in organic form. It's super helpful if you're making meads, ciders, things like that, that has, or if you're using a lot of adjunct sugar, something like a Belgian where you're putting maybe 20% sugar in, you need to supplement the fan. Okay.
So
you don't use any during the main ferment. How about you, Travis?
Sorry, Mike, because I really want to come back and ask you that question too about that. But I use Y yeast product that's a mix of dead yeast, et cetera, for my starters. But for when I pitch and repitch, it's zinc all the way. We had a discussion about that, and I made a calculator about that I probably didn't share a few discussions back.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I remember.
So starters. Sorry, Mike.
No, I said I remember.
Yeah, yeah. You remember that I didn't share it? I think I was supposed to share it.
I forgot until just
you
now.
You bastard.
So I use the Y yeast stuff. It's because I just use a pinch in my little, not in the starter, but also in my starter work, because I wake up my yeast on a repitch. But specifically on brew day, I'm using a zinc heptahydrate, mm-hmm. which is easier to deal with than a monohydrate by far. That's my nutrients.
You need like seven times more.
Close to it. Yeah. That H2O is a lot bigger than that Z.
Hepta, seven.
Seven heptas versus seven monohepta.
Water molecules, yeah. Versus one water molecule, yeah.
So one zinc. One little lonely, yeah. Zinc. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, it makes it a little easier when you're, as a homebrewer, you could use either. Either way, you're going to have to dilute it with water, because you don't want to overdose on zinc. Any nutrient you need to be careful with, because one of the issues is if you provide too much free amino nitrogen, your ferments are going to be too aggressive and are going to race, and you're going to end up with a lot of hot alcohols. So if you listen to the previous show where I bring up this paper, amino acid permeases in their influence on flavor compounds in beer. They mention it in there, but the issue is there's generally enough free amino nitrogen in an all malt wort, so you don't need to provide more to the yeast. So you should be fine in that when you're fermenting for flavor. If you provide too much, the fermentation is going to race. It's going to produce these amino acids are going to produce additional flavor compounds that you don't want. Michael's using it in his starters. You're not drinking the starter wort. You're not going to include that in your beer. You're going to, you know, let, you're going to decant the yeast from that starter and just use the yeast. And so you're fine there. But if you add too much, you know, a lot of times people will throw in a lot of, you know, a DAP or, you know, things like that. And that's going to be too much. And you're going to end up kind of screwing up your ferment. So, your flavor profile, should I say. So you want to be careful with that. You know, zinc is an important nutrient, especially, you know, when it comes to, and one of the reasons I always supplemented zinc is because the zinc and other compounds that can take the place of zinc in yeast, it's dependent on where the malt was grown, the soil conditions, things like that, because the barley plant takes it up from the ground into the barley that you use. And it's going to vary depending on the, you know, the conditions that it was grown in. And so you don't want to be deficient on that. That's a key part of fermentation, but you also don't want to overdo it either, which is Travis was talking about using heptahydrate, which has, you know, it's 7 times the weight of monohydrate. So it makes it a little easier to work with in that you're measuring larger amounts. But again, larger amounts in the homebrew world is you're talking about, you know, milligrams of this stuff. So it doesn't take much. So you what you do is you measure out a bit, you mix it in, you know, some sterile water, you know, in a liter of water, and then you use however many mils of that solution per batch. It makes it much easier. So
yeah.
Let's see here. Joe from Thailand, he was asking about again about we talked about recirculating the hops, dry hops, in the fermenter in the previous show. And he was asking about what type of pump is good for, you know, dry hops and agitating dry hops. Yeah, at Heretic we used a standard brewery pump. Low oxygen brewery pump for the recirculation of the fermenter. We talked about doing a peristaltic pump, and as long as you have tubing that is not oxygen permeable, you should be fine with a peristaltic pump on the homebrew scene. I'm not sure what material would be the best. Don't use silicone; it really allows a lot of oxygen through. So
isn't it a shame that a lot of the newer tubing you wouldn't want to put in a peristaltic? I mean, we have glass lined tubing these days,
right?
Super impermeable, but I don't think it will survive a peristaltic.
Right. You need flexible tubing to,
yeah,
the rotors going around, it squishes the tubing and it, you know, pinches the tubing and then pushes the liquid forward until the next pinch, you know, essentially grabs it and pushes it forward. There's generally three of those things in a peristaltic head. Right.
So I don't do what Michael said, but I'm a big fan of what he said. And I know you do it. You have done it in certain instances on the pro level of using something like CO2. Hmm. Disturb it and knock it up, right?
Yeah, you could.
You don't need to pull it out and redump it.
Right.
Right?
No? The problem is truly getting it stirred. Yeah, I could see blowing CO2 through the bottom or nitrogen through the bottom, depending on how pure your nitrogen is. Even CO2 has oxygen in it. Nitrogen, depending how pure it is. Even then, a little bit of oxygen, not a problem because there's a ton of yeast in there. But yeah, you could blow it up through the bottom and stir it. Just depends. You know, most of my experience with this is in the commercial world, and you'd be shocked at, you know, how big these cones are and how difficult it is to stir up everything from the cone. And really, you know, even just when it comes to multi-batching into a large fermenter, one of the problems that happens is the beer doesn't get stirred up enough. You can pump it in there and it just forms a layer up at the top.
Yeah.
And then you get a thermocline, and then temperature sensors go off, and it's just a huge problem in the commercial industry. So one of the great things about home brewing, and I've said this over and over, is that you can manhandle or womanhandle your fermenters. So
whatever your hands look like, manhandle and hands, whatever they look like, doesn't matter.
Whatever it is, we're all fine with that. But, you know, you could take your hands and you could, you know, grab a conical fermenter and you could swirl it around too.
I do that.
So if you were blowing, you know, CO2 up through the bottom to get stuff up there, and then you swirled it a bit, I think that would work. So yeah, that's a good point, Travis.
Sorry, I have one thing to add, but Michael hasn't had a chance to say anything.
So we don't care about Michael. He's
we love you,
Michael. His intro was terrible. So we're done.
I own that though. I own that.
Let's be glad he's not keeping score tonight, Michael, because I think we both suck. But anyway.
Oh yeah, right. Supposed to be.
I did have a couple of questions about pumping, because I can imagine on a 120 barrel fermenter, any, you know, purging the lines of oxygen and stuff isn't quite as imperative as it might be on the homebrew scale, where, you know, the volume of that tubing is non-zero for a tiny little fermenter, and 5 gallon, even a 2 gallon, whatever. So I was curious, maybe for the homebrewer out there, if you had any good ideas to purge the pump and the suction and feed and discharge line of air before you know, good way to prime the pump or something. I was thinking you might even like turn that thing on and basically let it spill out and then turn it off and then hook it up. Is that?
Yeah, you'd hook it up, squirt a little bit out, and then hook it up.
I know how much you like squirting a little bit out.
Exactly. Yeah.
Oh, now you fit right in.
Hey.
You squirt a little bit out your hose and then you hook it up.
Yeah. Every time
it can't be that far off to what you do when you transfer your beer, Michael. You know, like when I hook my hoses up, my hoses have been sanitized, purged with CO2, capped off the ends. I bet you're doing something at least as good as what I'm doing. Because your number one style is NEPA. It's far more critical than my number one style, which is a black double IPA. No one's going to see a couple of trees played out. So, yeah.
Yeah, so I mean,
you sanitize your lines, purge your lines, design a system that can be capped off, and then flush it with the beer before you start doing the recycle.
Right.
Yeah.
For me, when I transfer, like if I'm racking, I will actually have a partially pressurized keg, and I actually will hook up. So I'm like pushing CO2 out of my racking tube as I hook it up.
Same
thing.
So
a little bit like, and then I seal it all up.
My hoses are pre-purged with CO2 and capped off to a degree, and my keg is pressurized, blah, 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 get all up. But so the only thing I can add, and one thing I get a knock on that actually currently seems to be a bonus, I use hop screens because I can't stand to deal with plugged up kegs trying to transfer beer in and out. I just don't have the patience for it. It just freaks me out that I'm just going to screw up my entire beer. So my current hop screens are slightly customized, and they're narrow enough to fit end to end horizontal in my fermenter. And they are right now in my fermenter at the top. Hops are in solution. They're not at the bottom sitting on top of the yeast gate. So where I get knocks because, oh, you got the microscope hop screen, you won't get it, blah, 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 your beer won't see it. Mine are floating in my beer, not at the bottom of beer. And I did my second dry hop tonight, and I added my second tube, and the first tube was floating there right at the top. So 2 days ago when I dry hopped, which is a long ass time in modern hopping, it's been sitting there in the beer the whole time, not at the bottom, not on top of the cone, in the beer. So when I did tonight, I expected the same thing. I won't see this one because next thing I'm going to do is transfer after I chill after a couple of days. But so my hop screens are in the mix, not at the bottom.
Yeah.
Not seeing much of the beer.
The problem is, how big is your hop screen?
Well, small enough so they can be horizontal, because the 11 inch are too tall and wouldn't fit in my smaller one. So these are just like 10 9 3/4, so they can be parallel in
the entire fermenter.
Yes.
Right. See, I think that would be fine if you were recirculating the beer. And the problem is, I'm sure you've seen, fermentation where all the, if anybody's done it in a carboy where you see the bits of yeast and everything swirling around, that's what I
miss about
with the hops.
And I miss that about stainless.
You only need that for a few hours.
Yeah.
And that really extracts everything. If it's all sitting there in one spot, I think that's the issue. I think you're doing better than, letting it all sit in the bottom of the cone. But I think, everybody would do better to, quickly extract the good stuff out of the hops.
Do not disagree.
Get rid of the leaf matter. The leaf matter is not your friend, I think.
Well, last question I got. So Humber scale and commercial scale, I guess maybe they're the same, but where is your suction for your pump coming from? Is it the racking tube? Is it the bottom of the cone?
No, it's got to be your racking tube. You got to pull above the yeast.
That's a good question. And I'll tell you what, I will answer that right after this short break.
Back to the two guys that know how to turn beer into beer. This is Brew Strong.
All right, we're back. I was going to answer the question, where do you pull off of the bottom of the fermenter, the racking arm? So in homebrew conicals, they have a racking arm. They're designed very similarly to commercial fermenters. So there's a racking arm that is midway up the cone that turns. It's a curved arm that turns, and you can point it down lower in the fermenter or bring it up, to clear the yeast or, wherever you want to do it. I'm not sure where we ended up on this, because the point is, so we would first drop the yeast and get the yeast out of there, because we would use the yeast to pitch other beers. And then we would dry hop, because once the hops are mixed in, you can't really repitch that yeast. So I would have to look back to see what we ended up doing. But we tried both off the bottom and the racking arm. And I think my initial feeling was, let's just pull off the bottom. And I'm pretty sure that's what we ended up doing, was we just stuck with pulling directly off the bottom. Yeah. Because once we had dropped the yeast, it really didn't matter. And, a little bit of yeast recirculating around is no big deal. But we wanted to make sure we really cleared the cone. And with the racking arm, you're not going to clear the cone. And we wanted to, have it as homogeneous as possible. And then if you're a commercial brewer and you're looking at doing this, you don't even have to let the beer settle. It depends on what kind of centrifuge you're using. But if you have a centrifuge, you can recirculate the beer for 3 hours or however many hours it takes you to get a nice, good exchange and extract from the hops. And then you can even do it longer and then just go straight to the centrifuge where everything's in suspension. So your centrifuge can pull out the hops and all that, depending on the centrifuge you have, and, get your beer clear like that. If you don't have a centrifuge or you're not doing that, I mean, we ended up just letting it settle overnight, then dropping the hops, and then we would run the centrifuge from the racking arm and avoid the mass of hot matter and yeast and stuff like that.
We were making super hoppy beers.
Yes.
Other than that, like, you're showing off, maybe stroking a little bit, Yeah. Sorry.
I would also think too, like, you charge the hops, dry hop, and then kick the pump on. Don't let it all get to the bottom and then try to kick a pump on, because you're gonna just clog.
Right.
I would say it's the hops are in and then pump on right away. Right. I'm honestly, you got me thinking, I want to try to, if I can find a good pump online, try
absolutely it. Absolutely, you should give it a go.
A little homebrew setup.
Let's see right here. We got a question from Spencer, who says, "Hi, Jamel. I'm currently head brewer at a small brewery in the KC area." Kansas City. I love Kansas City.
Is that why you selected the question?
No. This is June 2nd, 2023. A great barbecue, great beer, great people, great football. It's a great town, great baseball, great MLS now, great place. One of these days, Travis, I'm going to get you out there.
Absolutely. I'm ready for it, I think. T-Rap's a bit young, but yeah, I want to go. We're going to go for a football game.
The number of times he told me he's ready for it and then really wasn't, I'm just saying. I will leave the name out in case I'm not here in 6 years when you get to this on the air. I'm a stickler for knockout pH. And I'm wondering if through your pro years and ungodly spreadsheet prowess, there's a mere that is mere mortals can only dream to obtain. If you ever found a way to more accurately calculate the acid additions for wort acidification, none of the calculators for water seem to even get close due to the fact that you have water chem and the buffering capacity of the sugars and other problems. Or other proteins in the wort against you. I have been using Beersmith's mash acid calculator. And while that has been dead on a couple of times, it tends to be hit or miss, sometimes way over or way under.
Comments, theories, and questions.
Now, both of you guys probably use Beersmith, yes?
I do.
You do?
I have.
Michael does not.
I use Palmer's Water Profile app.
Oh, nice. The one he offered in the water book.
Mm-hmm.
Or it's like,
it's on my phone. I can just bang, bang, bang.
Oh, nice.
Now, do you feel like have you tried Beersmith?
I have not. I actually use my own spreadsheets where I've grabbed the.
You like me, you try the free stuff and you just make your own stuff.
Yeah. I read the book and then I go, oh, there's the equation. I can integrate that into a spreadsheet or spreadsheet. Something.
Yeah, yeah.
Now, Travis, how do you feel about how well does Beersmith do when you're brewing a new style of beer that you've never brewed before? How close does it get you when you're brewing a new beer, your acid addition and all that?
All right. So it's a two-part answer because your question is not the same as our gentleman's question. The answer is on mash. Beersmith has two calculators. One is Beersmith's way, and you had a. I need to listen to it. You had a podcast with them recently, right?
Uh huh.
Yeah, I need to listen to that. I'd love to listen to that because I do use his software exclusively.
You should have him on this show. I'm going to make myself a note.
Don't do it at 3 p.m, so maybe Michael and I can join in. But anyway, his software gives you his calc, and it gives you. Bruin's calc. What's his name? The gentleman that does the Bruin spreadsheet. It's anyway. He gives you two calcs.
Ty?
I think so.
Yeah.
His software lets you select. I use the acid addition that puts me dead center between the two, and I am real close to balls on every time, especially with bigger beers. I mean, if one says I need 3 mL of phosphor, one says I need 6 mL of phosphor, I'm adding 4.5. I'm usually targeting 5.2 on the mash. And here's my clarification. And I get real close to 5.2 on the mash. But our gentleman's question was on knockout. And none of the above talks about knockout. All of the above talks about mash, not knockout.
Hmm.
Post-brewing. pH.
Well, knockout is going to be dependent on, you know, the boil.
Yes.
How vigorously you are boiling.
And maybe your whirlpool hops, et cetera.
Yeah, there's some, you know, inputs into that. Although, you know, knockout pH only drops a little bit.
And
versus mash pH?
Yes.
So you hop, a hefty dose of bittering hops and a great whirlpool, and your pH.
But if you have a high mash pH, you're going to have a high knockout pH.
I have a 5.2 mash pH almost every time, and I have a 5.4 knockout if I don't add more acid.
Interesting.
But that's anecdotal. My data, blah blah blah. It's not science, nothing like that. All but anyway.
Well, what we need to do is get Brad on here. And discuss this in depth. All right, Michael.
Well, I don't know. From the water guy, I guess that's my job. But I would say a couple things. Knockout pH. I'm having trouble really determining the drastic importance of that because right after you knock out, you're gonna pitch yeast, and yeast are gonna go to town. adjusting the pH to whatever they want. I mean, I almost think it'd be more if you're trying to build in how to brew. I took a note here, achieving the particular beer pH starts with the water chemistry and the mash pH. And that's John Palmer from his book To Your Ears.
I would agree with that. Yeah.
Yeah. And so, and he also says, like, you know, if you're doing these beers and you're getting to where you feel like you're getting all the flavors of what you're doing, your pH is where it should be for the final beer pH. And I just think if he really wanted to do it, though, like he wanted to nail your, the only way I can see, especially because, like he said, this is a soup of probably thousands of different molecules interacting with each other. There's real no way to construct a model to hit it dead nuts on first try. You're going to have to iteratively adjust and bracket, as they say in the mortar.
I feel the same way about IBU. You know, there's no calculator that can really identify it. You know, you hit it right in one model, you're going to miss on some other technique. So, that's an excellent point. All right. So what we should do is have Palmer on here so you can, Michael, you can rail him with all your water questions.
I wouldn't rail him, I would say. I mean, right. I have a,
how many people have railed him? I'm just saying.
I don't know. Yeah.
That's all right.
I like John, and I don't know if he understands my humor, so I will say nothing.
He doesn't understand my humor, so.
But he likes you too.
But
it's two ways for y'all.
16 years through, I don't think he's used to my stupid humor.
He's come back with zingers back in. He brings the heat with the inappropriate jokes. I'm just saying.
All right, we're gonna squeeze in one more question for William because he is asking live in the chat. Which is, if you're listening live, you can go to Facebook and listen live, and you can click on that comment section, and then you can ask your questions, or you can listen, you can see everybody else asking their questions. William asks a Jockey Box question: what do you recommend when storing between pouring? Some recommend storing a solution of star sand in lines and coils cold plate. I haven't had issues with star sand and quality stainless, but I've had issues with star sand and beer lines. Star sand and beer are both acidic, but star sand surfactant concerns me. I'm going to jump in.
Give me a shot first. He's a chemie.
Right. But the surfactant, I don't know.
That's not the issue, right?
It's not necessarily the issue, but the acidity, sure, you know, star sand is far more acidic than beer. And this is where I would, you know, ask Palmer for how does this interact with metal? And
hold off, Mike.
The issue would be, you know, any sort of air liquid interface on the metal is going to be a problem. It's going to corrode at that point for sure. I
know part of what Mike's going to say.
Okay.
Well, all right,
Mike. What do you think?
Dissimilar metals and acid.
I was gonna say.
Well, there's no dissimilar metals in there.
He's got the whole jockey box. He's got tubing. He's got clamps. He's got faucets. He's got a cold plate / coil. There's some dissimilar metals in there, and it's not going to be a good thing.
Well, the dissimilar metals need to be adjacent to each other.
No, they don't. That acid will be the bridge. That's what makes a battery.
Well, an electrolyte.
I mean, how far apart?
100 miles doesn't matter. Salt water, corrosion, bam. It's not going to be good.
And that's where my recommendation as the resident chemical engineer is to dry everything thoroughly. Mm-hmm. Store it dry, have it completely like blown air, no water. You're going to get better corrosion characteristics. Your hoses aren't going to turn color because of the star sand, which I've seen happen with mine.
Yeah,
you're not going to have any of that because it's dry, and dry is good for, you know, it actually has a lot of, you know, antimicrobial thing as long as it's dry and it's not damp and it's not got a bunch of food hanging out on it. If it's clean and dry, you should end up with a very nice, ready to rock jockey box.
The trick is trying to get any coil dry.
Yeah. Well, yeah. I can tell you humidity here sucks balls.
Right. But you can try and drain any coil of metal, and unless it's perfectly designed, there's always some more, yeah, you know, liquid that comes out of it. Every time you blow on it, you get more. You can store your counterflow chiller, and you know, a year later, you thought you blew it all out. A year later, you can blow some more liquid out. So,
but it's faster.
It's very difficult to get it dry. But I agree 100% with Michael. You need to get it dry. So if you can get the liquid out of there, it's going to be much better. I don't think the surfactant is a concern.
Soap. Yeah, you just soap.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's no big deal. Especially, you know, but get it dry, get it clean and dry if you can. The problem with the Jockey Box is you're going to have to at least turn it upside down. You know, if you blow air through it or CO2 through it or whatever you want to blow through it in one direction, you're going to have to flip it over and then blow it again. And then come back a few weeks later and try it again, and you'll get more liquid out. It'll always be impossible to get it completely dry. Yeah. But star sand is fine. I mean, water is not bad. You know, it's okay once you sanitize it to rinse it with, you know, clean water. But yeah, it's fine. The trick with a Jockey Box is to use it frequently.
Yep.
Drink more
beer. Tell your wife that.
Have more parties.
Gotta have more function.
Yes. William. The problem is storing it for a long time. If you're gonna store it for a long time, like Michael's saying, it's gotta be dry.
Yeah, and I would finish with when you're getting it out of the garage to use it again, I'd almost go through the entire cleaning and sanitizing process again.
Right.
Just to be sure. And then you're not gonna have any problems with flavor. Yeah.
But quality stainless will help. And one of the things about storing it dry is, you know, the layer that stainless will build up.
Passivated.
The natural passivation that will occurs with air. So you get it clean. So there's no protein or anything built up on it, and you expose it to air and it will passivate itself. So it'll improve its own resistive abilities to all the problems. So hopefully, William, that helps you. Thanks for tuning in live. Thanks for asking a question. We really appreciate everybody who listens. And if you appreciate this show, please send an email to feedback@blickmanengineering.com and tell John Blickman how much you appreciate the show. Because he's paying for the show. So if you don't tell him how much you enjoy it, he may stop paying for it. So please make sure you let him know that you appreciate it. We really appreciate you. We appreciate that you listen. We appreciate that you ask questions. Again, if you have questions and you can't tune in live, you can send them to brewstrong@thebrewingnetwork.com. And we're actually getting to the new ones really quick. We're not leaving them too sour for decades. We're able to keep up now. At least right now we're able to keep up. So ask your questions, or you know, pay attention to social media, Facebook. I posted on Jamel Zainashev on Facebook. I posted on Mastodon under, I don't know, Jamel Zainashev, Mr. Malty, one or the other. Twitter, it's Mr. Malty. Instagram, it's Jamel Zainashev. Travis is the beer ambassador on Twitter.
Twitter, I think, yeah.
TC Comble. Oh.
The beer ambassador.
The beer
ambassador.
The beer ambassador.
Yeah, I made up that stupid word about 2 decades ago. Yeah,
there you go. The beer ambassador. On Facebook, all that. And then Michael, what about you?
On Instagram, I'm South Reno Fermentary, so all one word. Or no, actually, there's underscores. South Reno Fermentary, and then on
underscores, on couple of ampersands. Yeah.
Yeah, all kinds of stuff, because, you know, you got to. But that's where I actually posted about the show that was going to be on today there. And so I think that's why I had one of the guys I know post about
there
it.
There you
so.
Go.
Pretty cool.
I will link you if I know what your social medias are. There you go. All right. Well, thank you, everyone. Appreciate everyone tuning in. I appreciate everybody listening on the podcast. I appreciate our co-host Travis Gommel, Michael Person. Appreciate all the effort everybody puts out into this, and especially John Blickman. We're paying for this. So
thank you, John.
The rest of the world.
Thanks, John. Have to.
All right. Till then, everybody, brew strong.
Brew strong.
Keep on brewing strong.